Our next case is 13-1731, State of Ohio versus Thomas Keenan. Sitting for Justice O'Donnell, who has recused, is Judge Jennifer Hensel from the 9th District. Welcome, Judge. Ms. Mullen?
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the Court, Catherine Mullen, on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office and the State of Ohio. I'm joined at the table today by Rick Bell, who is another member of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, in this case, the state requests that this court find that the trial court abused its discretion in dismissing the case as a multiple discovery violation that resulted from the same discovery violation that was the basis of the original sanction. I'm sorry. After the new trial was ordered in this case, the trial court sanctioned the state by precluding the use of prior testimony of a deceased witness, Edward Espinoza, without an opportunity to review whether or not that sanction was effective, and without considering the other alternatives as proposed by the state of Ohio, the trial court then proceeded to dismiss the case after plea negotiations had fallen through. We believe, Your Honor, and we did originally ask for summary reversal on this basis under State versus Darmond, where this court held that the standard from Lakewood versus Papadelis was applicable to violations by the prosecution. In that case, Your Honor, this court held that trial courts must impose the least severe sanction consistent with the rules of discovery. Now, the state argued, I was the prosecutor here for the argument in Darmond, and I argue to you again that dismissal is an option. I would never argue to this court that dismissal is not an option, nor that the court does not retain inherent authority to dismiss a case. I believe, though, that my argument last time and that the opinion in Darmond are consistent and that that work needs to be done. Dismissal with prejudice is the most severe sanction that can be employed against the state of Ohio. And in order to properly impose that sanction, the court needs to consider other less severe sanctions and impose the least severe sanction that is consistent with the purposes. As the dissenting judge in this case, Judge Gallagher, noted from the 8th District, the trial court had in fact already imposed a separate sanction, which was, as I mentioned, the preclusion of the testimony. However, the court then immediately proceeded to dismissal without looking at whether or not that sanction worked or was appropriate. I would suggest to this court that one of the ways to do that would have been to begin with the trial and find that that maybe wasn't an appropriate or strong enough remedy.
Counsel, isn't this the fourth trial we're talking about here?
This would be the third trial.
Third trial, and it was the event happened when? Over 20 years ago?
1988, Your Honor.
All right. Doesn't that play into what the trial court did here?
Well, and it did. And the trial court considered that in the terms of a case called State versus Larkins from the 8th District. Larkins was created by the 8th District, and it has only been cited by the 8th District outside of a case from the 10th District, which was a lawsuit brought by Larkins. So it is only being relied on as precedent alone within the 8th District. In State versus Larkins, similar to Keenan, the trial court dismissed the case because of discovery violations. The trial court did not make a finding as to what its constitutional basis was. It noted multiple different provisions might apply, but did not state which one. When Larkins went to the 8th District Court of Appeals, the 8th District did not affirm on any kind of constitutional basis, but instead reviewed based on a criminal rule application of the discovery rules. And in doing so, the Larkins court noted what this court has now answered in Darmond, which was whether or not Lakewood versus Papadelis applied. The court, without making a definitive, the 8th District in Larkins, without making a definitive answer on that topic, questioned whether or not Lakewood versus Papadelis standard was applicable to Larkins. They ultimately ended up concluding that Larkins could not be restored to the position that he would have been in during his initial trial. But that is not the standard. That hasn't been the standard. The standard is that once a defendant is successful in obtaining reversal, he goes back and stands for the charges in the original indictment. But
counsel, is it possible that the trial judge ordered dismissal because the judge felt without the testimony that had been excluded, you just couldn't make your case, and that the judge was pretty sure of that. Is that what was really going on at that point?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe if that was his decision, that's not what was stated in the record, and that's not what's in his journal entry of dismissal, which this court can find at in the record at number 330. But the journal entry of dismissal, and I believe on the record, he specifically references Criminal Rule 16 for the basis for the dismissal. So I believe that the record supports the idea that he made this decision as a discovery violation.
And the specific discovery violation here was what?
The discovery violations here are the same violations that were found by Judge Katz in the federal district court, which was the basis for the new trial. There was five different pieces that he found were Brady material, which the judge then granted a conditional writ ordering either release or retrial. The state elected to retry Defendant Keenan, which is how we wound up back at the trial court. We would argue, Your Honors, that in creating what they said in Larkins and then applying it again in Keenan, the trial court has done exactly what the Eighth District has done exactly what the dissenting judge mentioned, which was to create an unworkable standard. Because really what the trial court did was they created a hybrid of both a Criminal Rule 16 review as well as almost a pre-indictment delay type of analysis, combined those together to find that the defendant would have been prejudiced because of the years that have passed and the degraded memory. The problem with that analysis, Your Honor, is that there was never any evidence presented by Defendant Keenan to the trial court to support an argument of degraded memory, which is where the state's second proposition of law comes in. The defendant is required to make that evidentiary burden. He's required to demonstrate prejudice in order to satisfy that standard. He could have attached affidavits from witnesses saying that they couldn't remember. He could have brought witnesses in for the hearing to testify on this matter. There was no evidence at all presented on this issue.
Wasn't there evidence, counsel, of the death of at least one witness? And weren't there more? So wouldn't that be preclusive evidence that witness is unavailable without the need of an affidavit?
There are five witnesses that are deceased. But Keenan's, the main witness that has died is Edward Espinoza. Mm-hmm. On our argument in the motion to dismiss to the district court, the district court granted a conditional writ and allowed the opportunity for retrial knowing that Edward Espinoza was dead. So the fact that Edward Espinoza was dead was known during these entire proceedings. To argue prejudice now and ask for dismissal on the same basis that you've been granted a new trial is going too far.
But I think what your friends on the other side would say is habeas relief is separate. That's based on constitutional principles. It has nothing to do with discovery. So it was really up to the trial court to develop a discovery plan or the discovery parameters. Would you disagree with that?
I do in part, Your Honor. I think, first of all, that absolutely they're correct in that habeas relief is always constitutionally based. Brady, we know, is due process based for the failure to disclose exculpatory evidence. It is in itself, though, obviously a review of a discovery violation. And then when that gets to return to the trial court, I would, as I did earlier, admit that the trial court retains inherent authority to dismiss a case. But he has to do so within the confines of the applicable law. And the applicable law here is that if you're looking at a Criminal Rule 16 violation, you're required to consider and impose the least severe sanction consistent with the rules of discovery. That was not done in this case. The trial court instead, based on the erroneous Larkins decision, created a hybrid standard of these two different analysis to create this unworkable standard, which would essentially prevent the prosecution from retrying criminal defendants if their Brady violation was not found for a period of years.
So essentially the trial court should have stopped with the preclusion of the co-defendant's prior testimony.
That's what we would argue, Your Honor. We think that precluding Edward Espinoza's testimony was a sufficient sanction. He was our sole eyewitness to the murder case. And while we believe that we can proceed on that count with circumstantial evidence, it was obviously a very strong sanction to impose. And then he didn't, of course, like I mentioned, he did not then go any further to determine whether or not that sanction was effective. He just went ahead and dismissed the case on that same basis, using that same evidence.
But even in that order, saying that Espinoza's testimony would be precluded, wasn't there still left open the possibility that it could be used on impeachment or for impeachment purposes?
I believe in the journal entry, and that's number 324 in the record, Your Honor. I believe in the journal entry he did not, if I remember right, leave the opportunity open for Espinoza, but he did leave the opportunity open for Keenan and D'Ambrosio should they testify. But Edward Espinoza was entirely removed from the situation. I would note, Your Honor, and I'm sure that the defense will argue, that the federal court, Judge O'Malley, and the D'Ambrosio decision found that the defendant was prejudiced by the death of Edward Espinoza because he would not be allowed to cross-examine Edward Espinoza. Edward Espinoza has been now removed as a witness. Any of the Brady material that they want to use to cross-examine Edward Espinoza it's irrelevant. He's not there. He's not there as a witness. If their argument is that they're prejudiced because they want to claim that Espinoza is the real defendant, they can do that, just like many, many other defendants have done, which this court has seen. Defendants frequently point the finger at somebody else, even unknown other people, but here he would be pointing it at a prior co-defendant. He's capable of doing that on this retrial, even if Espinoza is not available, and even if Espinoza's testimony is not available. The other Brady violations that were found by the federal court are also addressed because many of our witnesses, as we've pointed out in our brief and in charts in our brief, are alive, willing to testify, and knowledgeable about the facts. And those other discovery violations and that undisclosed material can be brought in and used through those other witnesses.
Has Mr. Keenan been in custody for the 24 years or so that this has been going on?
He was, Your Honor. He's not in custody, obviously, right now, but he was.
He is not.
He is not in custody right now, no. But he, as I was stating, he can use that testimony against the other witnesses. The state, in addition, Your Honors, the state was willing to make stipulations to even allow some of the other evidence that it would have ordinarily had valid objections to be admissible. And this was a proposed alternative to dismissal. This was not made part of the trial court's findings. It's not clear if it was considered, and it is another less severe sanction that we believe would have been appropriate and could have been applied if additional sanctions were necessary. However, we argue that they are not, and that imposing multiple sanctions in and of itself violates this court's rule in Darmond, violates Lakewood versus Papadelis.
So the trial court ends a rather lengthy description of reasoning with the comment that the court is aware it has the obligation to provide the least severe sanction. It has several paragraphs explaining that. We have to determine if there was an abuse of discretion. Is that correct?
Correct.
That's the standard. You would agree?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes. And although the court did say that he was aware that he had to impose that, the analysis does not support that was done or that those were considered. And I understand that, obviously, an abuse of discretion is a heavy standard to overcome. But I think when we're dealing with a sanction as serious as preclusion of prosecution, that it's necessary that the findings are there, that the work is done, and that the reasons show up in the record so that this court and lower courts underneath it can properly review why a case was dismissed.
But counsel, if we're talking abuse of discretion, I'm not sure our role here today, because the Court of Appeals has already made that decision, correct? They decided that the trial court did not abuse its discretion. I'm looking at paragraph 72. The federal court determined that a fair trial had not taken place. I think everybody's in agreement on that, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
In 2012, the trial court decided it could not in the future. That's what they found. Are you asking me or we seven now to say they're wrong?
That they were wrong?
Trial court's wrong. They said there can't be a fair trial here. That's what the trial court said. That's what the Court of Appeals agreed with. Do you want us to disagree with them?
In that respect, yes, Your Honor, I do, because I believe that a fair trial can be had for all of the reasons that we've stated in our brief, for all of the charts and the explanations that we put into our brief of how those discovery violations can be cured and used. Keenan's upcoming...
And I read that, and it's all very good, and you did a very good job, but ultimately the trial court said, I've looked at everything here, there cannot be a fair trial. And then the Court of Appeals said that was not an abuse of discretion. So are you asking us to reach back to 2012, say, trial court, you're wrong?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, we are, because we believe that a fair trial can be had, and I think that the reason for finding they're wrong is the basis for the underlying legal principles, which is why we're here, which is that the court in Larkins and again in Keenan has created an entirely unworkable and circular standard which would preclude prosecution for these delayed Brady claims, and that cannot and should not be the standard. The general remedy for a Brady reversal is that it goes back to a new trial. I see, Your Honor, that I've used my time, and I would save whatever I have for rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court. I'm Tim Sweeney on behalf of Thomas Michael Keenan. This court should affirm the Court of Appeals, which had affirmed the trial court, and thereby join every other court that has looked at this shameful criminal prosecution since Judge O'Malley's grant of habeas relief in the co-defendant's case in 2006. This case has a tortured history that is an embarrassment to this prosecutor's office, and the trial court and the Court of Appeals here did the right thing. This wasn't the third trial. This was going to be the fifth trial. You had Keenan number one in 1989, where this court reversed because of prosecutorial misconduct. You had Keenan number two in 1994, which resulted in the grant of habeas relief by Judge Katz in 2012. You had D'Ambrosia number one in 1989, which was reversed or in habeas by Judge O'Malley. And then you had Keenan number two, which was the attempted prosecution by this prosecutor's office in 2009, where Judge O'Malley finally said, enough. You know, you guys have made enough errors. You've made, you've committed enough misconduct. You're not going to be permitted to go forward anymore with this prosecution. That's four times. This would be the fifth time.
Lest we forget, someone, the victim ended up with his throat sliced, and these people were all involved.
You know, I don't know, Your Honor. I don't accept that. I mean, well, there's my client.
There's a lot of evidence to the contrary.
My client has maintained the position all along, and he had nothing to do with the murder of Anthony Klein. And in fact, the evidence appeared to suggest, the state's own evidence, that it happened on a Friday-Saturday night at a time when Michael Keenan had an alibi, and not on a Thursday-Friday night that the state argued.
I don't challenge your assertion that the prosecutor's office or certain assistant prosecutors did some things, a number of things that shouldn't have happened. No question about that.
Right, and certainly there's a sensitivity to the victims, but yet there's also the requirement of a fair trial for the defendants, and that really here is what the trial court was most concerned about and why it did not abuse its discretion. That is the standard here. Did the trial court abuse its discretion?
Counsel, did the defense waive or invite error in some way by not appealing the federal court's order that said the state can either dismiss or retry?
No, not at all, Your Honor. I think the federal habeas grant of relief is generally going to be just that, that you will get a conditional writ, you will have the right to retry or release, and it leaves it within the hands of the state system to decide how that new trial should proceed.
So you would not have even had the opportunity to bring up discovery kind of issues and the circumstances under which he could be retried. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, they certainly in that habeas proceeding could have asked for a broader grant of a writ That did not happen here. They didn't ask for an unconditional writ. That was never litigated by the federal court. But even if they had, this is all about comity and federalism. A federal court is going to stay away from that, generally speaking, which is why in 2012, when Judge O'Malley finally granted the unconditional writ in the Ambrosius case, why it took so long. Because courts, federal courts, generally will not do that. That's an extraordinary thing to do. So it's unlikely that that would have ever been done by Judge Katz in Keenan's habeas case. What the court did was grant the conditional writ, as is ordinarily done with a Brady case, and did exactly what you suggested. That does not in any way preclude the state court from dismissing with prejudice, from making any rulings that that court may deem appropriate in the exercise of its discretion, which is exactly what happened here.
Counsel, I'm interested by the competing jurisdictions here. Did Judge O'Malley have the right to say this is over?
To say the DM
it's
wrote?
Over. The DM, it's over. There DM. Will be no more prosecutions.
Under the federal mm-hmm. Constitution and the federal habeas statute.
I like the menu that she suggested. She says, well, you can do this or you can do that. Did she have the authority just to say, this is over?
Under the federal Constitution and the federal habeas statute, her exercise of authority there was proper, and I believe it was affirmed by the Sixth Circuit, and it was honored by the state of Ohio. They never suggested anything.
No, that's not my question. I'm talking about, did she have the federal authority to say, this is over, there will be no more prosecutions?
You mean, could she have barred Keenan too, as well?
Three, four, and five, yes.
Yeah. Probably, Your Honor. I think my general view is that federal courts have a lot of power, and if the federal court had said that, I would suspect that maybe that she would have had the authority to do that. But in this case, in looking at the issue here, did the trial court abuse its discretion? It seems to me, and in light of Darmond, this is really sort of the easy case. I mean, Darmond said there are going to be situations where a dismissal with prejudice is appropriate. They're going to exist. We recognize that. And if you look at Darmond and you look at Parker and you look at Howard and you look at Parsons, those are all relatively, you know, straightforward cases, a first trial, you know, a relatively minor discovery violation, you know, not a Brady violation. We're talking about just sort of the first trial. None of those cases involve situations like we have here, where you've got 25 years passage of time, you got five dead witnesses, you've got Brady violations, you got a federal court so outraged with the state of Ohio that they order or bar re-prosecution of the guy's co-defendant. You know, this is the extraordinary case that Darmond visualized. It's the easy case where you can say, yeah, this is the time where a federal or a state trial judge, in the exercise of his discretion or her discretion, can look at all the facts and decide, can we get a fair trial here in light of everything that's happened, and applying a Rule 16 analysis, what is the appropriate remedy? And that's exactly what Judge Russo did here. His opinion, which I know the court has seen, was careful, it was thoughtful, it was done in a very deliberative manner. He specifically referenced the obligation to impose a least severe sanction if one was appropriate. He knew that that requirement existed. Darmond really wasn't the first case that said that. That existed, I think, as early as Parker, as the state's own briefs suggest. He did exactly what this court in Darmond said a trial court should do, and he did it with the exercise of wisdom and with a full understanding of the shameful history of this case. You know, and so when you sit here—
Counsel, notwithstanding any finding of egregiousness or the first two factors, I think the state is arguing that there just wasn't, even though the court elicited the proper language in the entry, there just wasn't the evidence of prejudice that was going to occur if he was going to be retried.
Yeah, I understand that, Your Honor. That is their argument, one of their arguments, and I would urge the court to soundly reject that, because the prejudice here is palpable. This, again, is an easy case of prejudice. You got the key witness dead. Edward Espinoza is the guy.
But isn't the key witness here, is the beauty of that for the defense, is you point to him as the empty chair. It seems to me that the state has the burden The defense has to establish reasonable doubt. You've got the witnesses that will put Espinoza, Keenan, and D'Ambrosio together, but it's the empty chair. That really is going to establish doubt here.
Yeah, but Your Honor, it seems to us, seems to the defense, that in order for a fair trial to occur and prejudice not to exist, you've got to be able to be in a position where you can meaningfully challenge the state's theory. You've got all this suppressed evidence here that nobody ever had the chance to use. So
but you would have the chance to use that suppressed evidence.
No, you wouldn't, Your Honor. You wouldn't be able to use it in a meaningful way, because you know why? You can't ask Espinoza about it. He's the guy you want to know. You want to know what he's going to say. What's Espinoza going to say about this Lewis situation? What's he going to say about Longenecker? What's he going to say about Winlock's claim that that this was all about Espinoza's wife? What's he going to say about that? What is Lewis going to say about what Espinoza says? None of those things are ever going to be able to be known, because Espinoza is never going to be able to be confronted. And that's
the original testimony of Espinoza didn't deal with any of those things.
You're right.
But Espinoza's testimony is excluded.
It is. It's excluded not as a sanction. It's excluded because the conduct of the state was so deplorable, it violated the Constitution. And so it was required to be excluded as a remedy by
the
Constitution.
Brady violation, right?
Well, no. The exclusion of Espinoza's testimony was because of Confrontation Clause issues.
Okay.
And other issues. But it wasn't a sanction for discovery violations. It was excluded because the conduct and the inability to confront that witness with all of this stuff that had never been produced denied the defendant the opportunity to confront him. So having never been confronted with any of the Brady stuff, you've got a cold record that is meaningless. And the inability to confront that witness is significant here, because it goes to the core of how you defend the case. It's true, he wouldn't be there testifying live or at all in this retrial, because his testimony has been barred and should have been barred. But where's the prejudice to Keenan? The prejudice is because he's never got the chance to ask Espinoza to confront him, and then to confront the other living witnesses with what Espinoza has to say. That's important to know what Espinoza has to say about this stuff. It's vitally important to know what Espinoza has to say about this stuff, because Keenan wouldn't even be in the snares of the county prosecutor and the Cleveland police if it hadn't been for Espinoza. He's the guy that says this stuff happened, that it happened on Thursday. He's the guy that says, I was down there at Doan Creek and I saw Keenan take this knife and slice this young kid, 19-year-old kid's throat. He's the guy that put Keenan on death row for 24 years. I mean, and so not to be able to confront Espinoza, a living man, and let the jury see him lie when he's confronted with this suppressed evidence is devastating. And I think the trial court knew that. And that, it seems to me, is why when you hear the state say, you know, we've been sanctioned already, they're wrong. Your cases, this court's cases, where it discusses discovery and Rule 16, never has it been a situation where you have consequences that are already dictated by the Constitution and the rules of evidence being asked to be treated as a sanction in a case like this. Never. None of these cases involve that situation. So what the state's saying here is you should treat as sanctions those things that were already required to do and that the court is already required to do by virtue of our misconduct. And that's simply not fair, and that's not just. Those aren't sanctions. They're not sanctions. They're consequences that already exist because of the state's misconduct. And if those consequences are treated as sanctions too, when you're doing a Rule 16 analysis, then the state is not being sanctioned at all. They're not being sanctioned at all. And that's really what they're asking. They're saying our conduct was so bad, and the consequences under the Constitution of our bad conduct is that our hands are going to be tied when we try this guy for a fifth time, and you should not sanction us anymore. And I think that argument should be rejected. It's not fair, it's not just, and it's not required under any of the cases, including Darmond, including any of the others that this court has decided. For those reasons, and I think my time is up, or maybe it isn't, I will, if there's no other questions, I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, which had affirmed the trial court, and which had, in our view, wisely exercised his discretion to dismiss this prosecution. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you use your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I wanted to point out just a couple of things. First of all, I was correct in my earlier statement. This is only going to be the third time that Keenan is tried. This is not the fifth time. And despite what the defendant has done at the 8th District and has repeatedly argued to this court, Mr. Keenan's last name is not D'Ambrosio. This is the third time that Keenan will be tried if this court were to reverse. Second, the defendant, in his brief in opposition to our motion to admit Espinoza's testimony, argued that Espinoza's testimony should be precluded as a Brady violation. Defendant's brief can be found in this court's record at number 288. The trial court's order precluding our use of Espinoza's testimony, again, in doing so, the trial court specifically referenced the Brady violations. That, again, can be found in this court's record at number 324. There are other witnesses which the state has located that are available, that are able to testify, other than Espinoza, that link Keenan to these crimes. The evidence does not rest solely on Edward Espinoza. While Espinoza was critically important because he was our sole eyewitness, and obviously the preclusion of his testimony will substantially harm the case, the state is prepared evidentiary-wise to proceed. So to overstate Espinoza or to say that they are prejudiced by not having the ability to use Espinoza, you have to look at that in the context of the fact that Espinoza is not the only witness in this case. But in addition,
Espinoza the only witness who would be able to discredit what your witnesses, you said you had five witnesses that you, did I hear you say that?
We have at least five witnesses.
At least five witnesses. Is the fact that Espinoza is not available, not only the benefit of his testimony not being able to be used by the state, but is from the defense point of view, he would contradict what your other five would say?
No, that would not have been the only way to contradict or to use the undisclosed evidence. Paul Lewis, which is another one of the people that they frequently argue, he's alive and available to testify. Christopher Longnecker, the subject of the rape that they've used for some of these other Brady violations, he's alive, he's ready and able to testify. The detective, I believe, Hayes and Goldstein, which were the topic of the other Brady topic because they believed that the victim might have been killed in a different location, they're alive, they're located, they're able to testify. All of these people are around, all of these people are available, all of that evidence can come through these other people. And I would reference this court actually to a quote in a case that the defense relied on in their brief, and it's a very old U.S. Supreme Court case, Maddox versus United States. But in that case, the court was facing a situation where one of the witnesses who had testified previously was deceased. And the court said, the fact that one party has lost the power of contradicting his adversary's witness is really no greater hardship to him than the fact that his adversary has lost the opportunity of recalling his witness and explaining what his testimony would have been to him. The loss of Espinoza cuts heavily against the state. The idea that the defense might have called him to use him, presumably to maybe impeach other witnesses, that would be a very risky strategic thing to do, as Espinoza has, of course, twice identified Keenan as one of the murderers. I'd be very surprised if that was a course that the defense would take on remand.
Counsel, I'm trying to remember the first trial in Carmen Marino's. That's really what prompted, I think, this court to reverse is his using the knife.
Correct, Your Honor.
You still have the knife, right?
Correct, Your Honor, we do.
And the evidence is how you obtained that.
How do we obtain the evidence?
I mean, you would have the witnesses who can indicate how the knife that was involved in
absolutely, Your Honor, and not just the knife. I mean, we have the, you know, the truck with the white paint in the bed that is, for reasons I don't have time to explain, very relevant. There's a lot of other circumstantial physical evidence that certainly puts Mr. Keenan as being involved in this murder. I would also, as a final thing, Your Honors, note that in State versus Wilson, which I relied on in my briefing from the Third District, is from 2013, they note that when a discovery violation occurs during trial, it's not reviewed for Brady. It's reviewed under the criminal rules. The Brady violations were the circumstances of the district court's reversal because that was looked at historically. Here, we're ready to go to trial for the third time. Keenan has been now in possession of this evidence that he previously didn't have. Going forward, the trial court should not have reviewed this under Brady. Going forward, it should have been reviewed under Criminal Rule 16 because at that point, Keenan was in possession of the evidence going forward, so it was not a Brady violation, which then goes back to the idea that when he has to argue prejudice, he has to present evidence to support his claim that memories have dimmed, that witnesses are unavailable, things like that. And outside of the witnesses that we know are deceased, but which still provided the federal court with the opportunity of retrial, the defendant didn't do that. He didn't present any of that evidence. We would ask Your Honors to reverse the unworkable standard created by the Eighth District.
Also, the testimony, there's deceased witnesses, that their testimony has not been excluded by the federal court order, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, all right.
So we would ask this court to reverse the unworkable standard created by the Eighth District and remand this matter so that we can proceed to trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.